Chapter 7. Russia mobilizes. It is a strange fact that Maurice Paleologue was charged almost exclusively with the conduct of France's relations with Russia. The French Prime Minister, Viviani, was also Foreign Minister, constitutionally Paleologue's superior, while Viviani was en route to and from St. Petersburg. The Minister of Justice, Bienvenu-Martin, had been appointed acting Foreign Minister. The truth is that Viviani had little authority. Poincaré viewed his prime minister with hauteur and suspicion, and often worked behind his back. Paleologue was contemptuous of his superior, of whom he said, "Viviani doesn't have the slightest notion of diplomatic affairs, he is as sluggish as a dormouse and the most foul-mouthed of all our politicians." Shunted aside, treated with contempt, Viviani would go mad and end up in an asylum. As for the interim foreign minister, J.B. Bienvenu-Martin, he played an almost non-existent role during his brief tenure. Abel Ferry, state secretary in the foreign ministry, wrote of him in his carnets, notebooks, "The minister comes in only 45 minutes a day, and the mice do play." While Bienvenu-Martin stayed away, and Viviani was outmaneuvered, the foreign ministry swarmed with unofficial diplomats, operators such as Tardieu, who considered the place his private preserve, wandering through the offices on the Quai d'Orsay with an elegant cigarette holder protruding from his lugubrious fish face. The most powerful diplomat on the spot was not Viviani or Bienvenu-Martin, but the political director, Secretary General Philippe Berthelot. He was scarcely a force for an honest diplomacy rooted in mutual trust and conciliation. It was Berthelot who edited the Yellow Book. No sooner had the France left the dock in St. Petersburg than Paleologue got to work. He invited Sazonov, the Russian foreign minister, to have lunch with him at halt, past 12 the next day, July 24. For the next 3 days the two men would confer almost without interruption. At the luncheon meeting on the 24th, Paleologue duly transmitted to Sazonov the secret watchword he had just received telegraphically from Poincaré on the France: "Stand firm. Stand firm." The French minister was abetted by a second guest at the diplomatic lunch. Great Britain's ambassador, Sir George Buchanan, rivaled Sazonov in his enthusiasm for the Russian cause. Far from being a dispassionate and neutral emissary of Britain, Buchanan was a strong supporter of Grand Duke Nicholas and his Panslav ambitions. At the lunch, when Sazonov and Paleologue urged him to support France and Russia, he replied unhesitatingly, "You're preaching to the converted." Sazonov, who had just ordered Serbia's Prime Minister Pašić to reject Austria's sixth condition for a settlement of the Sarajevo affair, that a joint commission of inquiry be appointed, saw his hand immeasurably strengthened by this strong intimation of official British support. He stiffened his back yet more, urging Pašić that both he and the Serbian regent should leave Belgrade immediately in preparation for the hostilities. Pašić complied with that demand quickly enough, sending his family to Paris immediately. On the 25th, Serbia made her counterproposal to Austria, accepting those demands which inconvenienced the Pašić government and its Russian patrons least, but turning down those central to the Austrian position. In accordance with Sazonov's orders, Pašić presented a counterproposal to the Austrian ambassador in which he declared that his government was willing to punish the culprits, but only after they had been proven guilty by an investigation which involved no Austrians. Doubtless this was an understandable position, given that Pašić knew full well who had organized the assassination plot, and that he walked to his offices every morning with the chief conspirator in the Balkans, Russia's minister, Hartwig. As Pašić and his Russian mentors both knew, however, the Serbian rejection of Austria's demands meant war. On the same day that Paleologue, Sazonov, and Buchanan had intrigued over tea, the Russian leadership, secure in its knowledge of the Serbian response to Austria on the next day, began to mobilize its ponderous armies. Sazonov laid a plan for regional mobilization before the Tsar that afternoon, the 24th, which provided for putting the troops of the Moscow, Kiev, and Kazan military districts on a war footing. Establishment histories speak of Russia's mobilization as having occurred a week later, on the 30th or 31st. The earlier regional, preliminary, mobilization is dismissed as merely a defensive measure to forestall a rapacious Austria bent on crushing Little Serbia. Generally glossed over is the fact that the Russian fleets of both the Baltic and the Black Sea were ordered to mobilize as well. Clearly, this was more than a regional mobilization. The Black Sea was far from any of the actors in the Serbian crisis, and no canal linked the Baltic to the Danube. Clearly, the Russians were taking aim at a plum long coveted by the imperialist ideologues of Russian expansion: Tsargrad, Constantinople, Istanbul, the capital of the Ottoman Empire, a plum long worth more to the Tsarists than all the plum trees in Serbia. By mobilizing in the Baltic, just as clearly, the Russian expansionists were preparing to strike against Germany. By mobilizing the Baltic fleet, the Russians were presenting the Kaiser and his ministers with a provocation close to unacceptable. Tsar Nicholas II was not a perfidious man. He wouldn't have hurt a fly, even if he had possessed the requisite energy. But he was little more lively than a corpse. A close friend said of the Russian ruler, if you asked him an important question, he seemed to fall into a cataleptic trance. Thus he was putty in the hands of advisers and ministers like Sazonov. The foreign minister quickly prevailed on him to endorse the plan for partial mobilization, which was then approved by the Council of Ministers at Krasnoye Selo on the 25th. The regional, or partial, mobilization begun by this decision was, in line with the military realities of the day, anything but partial. Once set in motion, mobilization proceeded according to fixed plans which couldn't be altered, and was all but irrevocable. The Tsar knew little of strategy and tactics, and was blissfully unaware that he had committed his nation to a course from which there was no turning back when he complied with Sazonov's request. Even then, there were Russian troops who had been feverishly set in motion weeks before the decision to mobilize on July 24, 1914. 20 days before, the 60,000 troops who had so impressed Poincaré as they strutted to French martial music at Krasnoye Selo had been recalled from Siberia by the General Staff. The snows of Siberia had melted during the brief northern summer. It was the boast of the General Staff that the Siberian troops would be in Berlin before the snows returned to Russia's vast Asiatic expanse. On July 25, Grand Duke Nicholas entertained at a grand military banquet. There the Germans first got wind of Russia's ruler's decision for war. General von Chilius, the Kaiser's personal military representative at the court of the Tsar, had been seated beside Nicholas's chief equerry, Baron Grunwald, an old friend. When the toasts were being made, the Russian marshal looked gravely at the German, raised his glass to him with deep emotion, and said, "My dear comrade, I am not authorized to tell you what was decided at noon today, but it was very serious." Then, placing his hand on von Chilius's arm, he added, "Let us hope that we shall see each other again in better days." It was goodbye, then. The Russian officer could scarcely have been more explicit. He knew that a war was on the way, and he was taking leave of his friend, hours before the Serbians would present their rejection to the Austrians. It was Grand Duke Nicholas who was the star of the banquet, however. Before 2,000 newly minted officers from the military academy at St. Petersburg, all hastily commissioned hours before, the Russian commander-in-chief put on an exuberant theatrical performance, calculated to rouse the Russian soldiers to a fever pitch of bellicosity. The hall was flooded with joyous song, to the accompaniment of glasses, emptied of vodka, being smashed on the floor, in the Russian manner. Yet another Russian was rejoicing in St. Petersburg that day. Alexander Izvolsky, who had schemed for a war since 1906, who had set another river besides the Seine flowing into Paris, a river of gold, who had bribed and corrupted the press, was on the scene to see his labor finally bear fruit. He had returned to his capital to keep watch lest Poincaré slow things down through any adherence to diplomatic or legal formalities. He needn't have worried, Sazonov and Grand Duke Nicholas did their work well. Now it only remained for Izvolsky to return to Paris, to observe the final French preparations and to stand ready to push the French leaders over the brink if they showed last-minute signs of hesitation. On the evening of the 25th, Izvolsky boarded the train for Paris. His French colleague, Paleologue, tossing discretion to the winds, accompanied him to the station and to his personal railway car. Izvolsky, square-faced, with the features of a Kalmuck, beamed. With a triumphant cry, he assured the Frenchmen, "This time it's war." Then both men kissed each other in the Russian fashion, on the mouth. Shortly afterward, the Russian ambassador's train set off for Paris. The next morning, Paleolog telegraphed Paris to inform his government that the Russian mobilization was underway. Neither on that day, the 26th, nor on any succeeding day did the French leaders remonstrate with the Russians or seek to inhibit their actions in any way, thereby supplying further evidence of the Poincaré government's collusion with the Russian imperialists. Needless to say, the Yellow Book's editor chose to omit this telegram from its allegedly comprehensive documentation of the origins of the war. For some years, Poincaré believed that by eliminating the incriminating evidence from the government's official account of the events of July 1914, he could wash himself clean of any suspicions and accusations. His pedestrian mentality failed to anticipate that the cataclysm he was calling forth by his secret machinations might bring about fundamental changes in the political order in which he had learned to serve himself so well. 10 years after the war, Sergei Dmitrievich Sazonov, the Russian foreign minister with whom Poincaré had so cleverly arranged the war, found himself in exile from his native Russia, which lay in ruins, chastised by a more fearsome knout than any of the Tsars could ever have hoped to wield. The collapse of the old order had left him with little appetite to cover up Poincaré's doings, and in his Sechschwer Jahr, published in English as Fateful Years, he revealed the truth about Paleolog's telegram to Paris, and another historical lie crumbled into rubble. Izvolsky arrived in Paris on the 29th. The telegram had preceded him, of course, and Poincaré was well prepared to cooperate with the Russian ambassador when the envoy presented himself at the Élysée Palace. The French president was secretly delighted by the unscrupulous measures the Russians had been taking to force the issue with Germany and Austria. Poincaré craved war even more ardently than the Russians. After 2 years of striving, he was about to get his wish.